on the 31st, that means you got to get your permanent fund request in, at 1:37. Today we will hear first Senate Bill 133, Aviation Advisory Board from DOT, and it's the intent of the chair to, if at all possible, to get this moved out today, so I would ask us to approach it in that vein. Kip?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Kip Knutson. I'm a deputy commissioner for aviation at the Department of Transportation. This board, I'll just give you the skinny here. This board has been a very effective policy tool for the department in the 2 years that it's been in existence. The origin of it was during a transition process that Governor Murkowski started. Aviation industry, aviation interests recommended that the governor form such a body. Right now it's renewed each year through an administrative order, and it's certainly the recommendation of the commissioner and certainly myself that this become a permanent group. It's been tremendously helpful to us in taking care of aviation issues. There's a sectional analysis in your packet.
One second, if you would. Did this exist prior to Governor Murkowski?
No, sir.
Okay. So this is a new function completely. Good. Thanks.
There may have been an advisory board under Hammond, I believe, but it didn't survive much under that administration and hasn't been in place since then. So, anyway, there is a sectional analysis in your packet. I'm happy to go through it, but I would be loath to slow anything down, so maybe I just make myself available for questions, unless you'd like some more information on the bill.
Yeah, at this time, I'd like to acknowledge we have Senator Terrio, Senator Cowdery, Senator French, and Huggins present for quorum.
Senator Cowdery. What's the purpose of this, having the commissioner consult with the board on the hiring? Are we trying to micromanage things, or?
Through the chair, Senator Cowdery, I know that it's not in any of the current advisory board members to want to micromanage. I think it's enough of a political hotbed position that they want to be consulted just to make sure that the choice is as good as some of the choices we've made in recent past. There's no hiring going on here in near term that we're aware of. It's just it's such a big position in each community, such a critical element for the communities that I think the board wanted to just at least be part of the process.
And the systems worked well in the past without this?
The hiring of airport directors? Prior to the current director at Anchorage, there was a pretty quick turnover of directors at the airport, and I believe some of this is sort of the memory of that time frame. It was about an 8 or 9 year period.
Was that because of the qualifications of the people? That maybe not as qualified as they should be for that job?
Would have been. I'd hate to comment. I wasn't involved in even close to the hiring of those various directors. I know that there's a lot of allegations, but some political wins, maybe some qualification issues, but I think the board just wants to be consulted. That's their intent.
Seems to me that, one last, just a comment, that it should be an independent decision of the commissioner. Because if there's flack downstream, the commissioner is going to end up taking the flack, and it's not going to be the board. That's just a comment. Anyway, that's all I have.
As I understand it, the hiring is, in any advice from the board, is advisory. Is that correct?
On all matters, it's purely advisory. They have no veto or override ability. So,
Senator Terrio.
So, as a representative for the administration, that's maybe not a diminishment of the administration's absolute power, but puts a little bit of a cloud on it. So, if you're willing to offer that up, basically.
Yeah, I think it's certainly been the governor's opinion and commissioners, in my opinion, that these are such critical infrastructure elements for these communities that, you know, community consultation, particularly with the aviation community, is really an essential element to these appointments.
And this provision is supported by the administration, the governor, in this case?
Yes, sir.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Frank.
It sounds like the purpose of this board is essentially to not so much vet as comment on the selection of these two individuals who will run either the Ted Stevens Airport or the Fairbanks Airport. And we pay about $20,000 a year to have this group available to comment on these openings. Besides that, what does this group do?
The vetting of the candidates for these various director positions is probably the smallest portion of what they would occupy themselves with. What we have used the board for so far is to present them policies we have in place relative to our airport system, and have them discuss the implications of that policy, implications of changing it. New policies come in, new requirements come in from, you know, either the federal government or state government, whatever. These would be future topics for this board to address. And it's just to make sure that a department is making system decisions with the correct advice from huge user communities of that system. So,
how often does the board meet?
They have met, I believe, 10 times since their first creation. They're not obligated, I think, in the statute more than once a year, but we've kind of tried to keep them to a quarterly basis if possible. Otherwise, they just burn out. I mean, they're all primarily volunteers, and that's a big chunk of time out of their day.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
When you look at, I notice that there's a couple of communities here singled out for representation. In this case, Mayor of Anchorage has representation. A member who jointly represents the mayor's, the city of Fairbanks, and the North Star Borough. Any questions ever come up in that respect about some communities being designated and others not?
Not so far. And the reason those two are singled out is just simply because the huge facilities in those two communities and, you know, the large influence they play is in each of those communities. But so far, no, the board has met, you know, the preponderance of the members right now are from the South Central region, and occasionally a member from Ketchikan or Bettles will, you know, complain that they're being outshouted, but for all intents and purposes, no, there's not been any substantive discontent with the current structure.
Follow up on that. When when you look at these members, are I don't know, let's just take Anchorage as an example. Are you looking for somebody with aviation expertise? I'm not saying you need to be totally prescriptive, but do you have any concern about, you know, just what the credentials are of the person that comes from the different locales?
You know, when the governor was first appointing the advisory board, he met with the mayors at that time, and they asked the governor at that time, well, who would you like to see? And, you know, the governor didn't want to proscribe too much their choices, but both mayors put people on that had significant aviation background. So, yeah.
So I guess my question is, are you satisfied with the generic language of just a representative, or do we want some place, some implication of aviation expertise so that?
Mr. Chairman, I think the broader description is fine. I think that people generally are focused on the mission of the board, and they generally put the right person on it. Quite frankly, if they put somebody that didn't know a thing about aviation, we might get some very interesting and useful comments out of that individual. Everybody's a user, so.
Senator Cowdery?
How long has this commission been in existence? 2 years?
Yeah. A little less? Effectively 2 years. January 2003, I think.
How many recommendations have they made that have been followed? Or do, this?
Well, they have made one formal, they've taken one formal resolution, which was then forwarded to the governor, and the governor didn't follow it at this point. So.
I'm just thinking too many cooks in the kitchen, you know. I think Mort Plum does a pretty good job, and I'm sure the Fairbanks director does a good job. So, anyway, I think whoever picked them did the right thing.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, just to reiterate that they haven't had anything to do with hiring or firing of directors so far, because that was all done pretty much prior to their existence, and we don't foresee any hiring going on in the near future either. So,
Terrio.
Thank you. The compensation. You have no pay, but they get travel expenses and per diem. But yet the fiscal note is zero, so this is just all going to be, or was it already submitted in the 06 budget?
Yes, sir.
So it's not just absorbed and, okay.
It is in the governor's 06 submittal. And I believe the total amount was $20,000 for the activity.
And the meetings are held in Anchorage?
No, they're rotated. Well, we've had them in Ketchikan, Anchorage, and Fairbanks, and Juneau so far.
The Millennium Aviation Program, has this board had any taskings or oversight or any sort of implications on that?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, the Millennium Program?
Yeah, as I recall, the Millennium Program, which is part of the navigational system.
Oh, the Medallion Program.
Medallion, I'm sorry, Medallion.
This one.
Yes.
The advisory board, Mr. Chairman, has adhered pretty closely to the department's mission, which is to provide for the movement of people and goods basically through the provision of airport facilities. So Medallion is somewhat out of our mission statement. Many of the members, however, are intimately involved with that program. Both the Medallion program, and then certainly some of the people that are aircraft operators are participating in the Capstone program. So, and we've had the FAA come and talk about some of these safety programs and their impact on airport facilities. But it's really sort of stuck pretty close to the airport world so far in their advice. And
any role in the annual aviation trade show?
No. Again, I think every member is an active participant, but no active role as an advisory board per se.
Other questions? Kip, if you would stand by.
Yes, sir.
And Karen Casanovas? Hello, Karen?
Yes.
Can you hear us okay? Yes, if you would please state your name and your affiliation, and we're prepared for your testimony.
Karen Casanovas, Executive Director for the Alaska Air Carriers Association.
Yeah, thank you for being with us today, Karen. If you would just continue on with your testimony.
Okay. Chairman Huggins and members of the committee, the Alaska Air Carriers Association strongly supports SB 133, and we do again support the establishment in permanence of the Aviation Advisory Board. We feel that this bill would create a permanent positive impact on the air carriers operating in the state, and the Aviation Advisory Board, as proposed in its purpose, hearings, meeting schedule, and composite, will serve those in our membership well by providing a forum to voice concerns. With the current grim economic situation for many of our members, we feel that the State of Alaska Administration should continue to help and promote the increase of aviation businesses, not hinder it. And we feel by giving influence to those operating in this industry for high-level decision-making, this is certainly a step in the right direction. Our concern is, and the association is, to promote aviation safety and the long-term health of the industry. And our position as an association reflects that position to foster and support a stable commercial aviation industry founded upon the principles of safety, professionalism, and longevity. We feel that since our association was founded in 1966 and we represent over 160 commercial aviation carriers and businesses throughout the nation, we feel that the support of SB 133 would certainly be for the betterment of aviation with regard to policy making in Alaska. And I can answer any questions that you might have. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much, Karen, and we appreciate your testimony. Questions for Karen? Good. Thank you, Karen. Could you remain with us in case we have some questions in a few moments?
I can, and I just wanted to comment if I just could maybe answer some of the other questions, and I'm sorry I don't know who asked them earlier, just regarding some of the agenda items from previous meetings, and they did discuss bond funding and the DOT and their multiple priorities as they relate to roads, marine, or aviation. They talked about construction. They did discuss the airport manager's hiring process, the expansion of the leasing regarding aviation and reporting to the Deputy Commissioner of Aviation. And they also discussed Kenai, Juneau, Merrill Field, and the Ketchikan airports. So I'm sorry I don't know who asked the question regarding the priorities just being given to Anchorage and Fairbanks, but it seems as though the topics they have discussed did cover the whole state, not just those two airports.
Right. Okay, good. Karen, I do have, this is Chairman Huggins. I do have a question for you in regards to aviation insurance. I mean, I think some of us understand what a challenge that's become for both operators and individuals. Has that subject to date been addressed?
I think that it probably has been addressed just briefly. It's not my understanding that it has been discussed at great length. I think Kip could certainly answer that question better, but it continues to be one of the highest costs for businesses operating in the state.
Okay, thanks. Kip?
Mr. Chairman, the topic of carrier insurance hasn't been a direct topic. It certainly is undercurrent at every meeting, and it's oftentimes brought up as an issue of what kind of leasing policy we should have, whether we should require certain limits on insurance, et cetera. Oddly enough, airport operator insurance has been a very hot topic for the group because there are very few local sponsor airports in the state. In other words, DOT runs most, but there's a few communities that have been brave enough to take on airports, and obviously the insurance to cover that operation is in the same situation as the air carrier insurance. It's just gone up and gotten a lot more expensive and complicated. So that's been a topic of discussion.
Help me out here for a moment. As I recall, the air carriers operate under Part 121.
Well, 121 or 135, and then some of the guide operations are under the Part 91 of the FAA regulations.
But Part 135 operators probably have, there's probably a different challenge when it comes to insurance between Part 121 and Part 135. Is that accurate or am I off base?
I'd yield to the expert, Karen Casanovas, but I believe the 121 carriers are big enough that the insurance market is less terrifying for them. It's the smaller 135 operators that are really the ones squeezed by the insurance situation of late.
Karen, can you help us out on that?
Chairman Huggins, I'm sorry,
was that who was
answering the question?
Yeah, the question was your perspective on Part 121 versus Part 135 and the challenge of sustaining insurance, aviation insurance.
Yes, that continues to be, again, an issue for many of the carriers, and I know that there are some insurance underwriters today that are giving a cost break if they participate in the Medallion Foundation program. There's also some independent carriers that are offering an insurance break, such as a Benco. For general aviation pilots, they're possibly receiving up to a 10% reduction, but it still does remain one of the biggest costs. And I think that if you compare the 121 and 135 operators, while it may be labor and some other costs that are higher for the 121 carrier, certainly for a 135 operator, it, again, is probably maybe third or fourth as far as their expenses go.
Okay. Good. Karen, thank you very much. You'd stand by, please. Tom George, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Yeah, Tom, if you could give us your full name and your affiliation, and we'll be prepared for your testimony.
All right, my name is Tom George. I serve as the Alaska representative of the Aircraft Owners and Pilots Association. We have over 404,000 members nationally and about 4,600 here in Alaska. AOPA supports Senate Bill 133 and making the Aviation Advisory Board permanent as a way to get advice to the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. Just given the critical role aviation plays in Alaska, we think that we need a way like this for the aviation community to interact with the department as it sets policy and makes management decisions regarding aviation. We also think that this bill provides for selection of board members from different stakeholders in the aviation community and from the different portions of the state, which are a pretty balanced approach to giving this advice to the department. So with that, I'd say thanks for the opportunity to be heard on this matter and be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Yeah, Tom, when it comes to, you probably do not have a copy of the bill before you, correct?
Actually, I do.
Okay. Do you have any concern as far as the representation and the task that the board faces?
No, this is about the same basis for representation that they have been operating under, I believe, and I think there's no perfect way to do this, but this so far I think has been pretty balanced and has resulted in a good balance of the group, both geographically and from the different portions of the aviation community and the stakeholder communities.
Right, but in that respect, Tom, if you look at it from the average person that flies in Alaska, from the broadest perspective, are there some things that you would like to see come under this umbrella that maybe may not have any specificity to it?
Not that I could identify at the moment. I'm sure with experience, the wrinkles will come out.
Okay. All right. Other questions for Tom? Tom, you remember Dale Conover?
Russell? Only vaguely.
Yeah. The airfield liability, private. Anyway, I'd like to talk to you about that sometime. Different subject.
Okay, happy to.
Yeah, different time. Thank you very much for joining with us.
My pleasure.
Okay, is Russ Painter here?
Here.
Hey, Russ, Charlie Huggins. I'm sorry, I misinterpreted your location. And oh, by the way, it's snowing here. How's it doing in Anchorage?
Oh, we're sunny.
Oh, you are.
Warm.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure it'll be raining here anytime, so don't worry about us. Russ, would you give us your name, affiliation, and we're prepared for your testimony.
Yes, sir. Thank you. Russ Painter, the president of the Alaska Airmen's Association. And the Alaska Airmen's Association is a nonprofit organization formed in 1951 to promote general aviation in the state of Alaska. We represent 2,100 aviation members. Of our board of 14 members, four are regional directors covering the north, southeast, south central, and western regions of the state. The Alaska Airmen's Association strongly supports Senate Bill 133 and would like to thank Governor Murkowski for his foresight in sponsoring this bill. And thank you.
Well, thanks, Russ. Questions for us?
No.
Okay, so, Russ, I gather from your testimony that you are satisfied with the bill as it is written.
Yes, sir. I think, as Tom mentioned, it covers a good cross-section of the state's aviation interest, and if we do get individuals that don't have the aviation experience, like Kip said, we may get some interesting comments and open our eyes to some areas that we haven't seen.
Okay, thank you very much, Russ. Let the record show that Senator Kukesh has joined us.
I got calm that snore out there. I stopped in two doorways trying to get back here.
Did you really?
Yeah.
Okay, with that, other comments, questions for Kip, or is there, if there's someone in the audience that has something they add that's germane?
Oh,
1616.
Ready for a motion?
Unless there are members of the committee that have any comments.
Yeah, I move that we move Senate Bill 133 forward to the next committee of referral, which is Leo Fiskenoff, which I believe is finance.
Correct. Okay, good. Objections? Comments? Good, very good. Well, congratulations, Kip. Good luck with your 11 members.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yep. Thank you. Okay, well, let's take about a three-moment break, and we will charge right into Senate Bill 16. We actually have a committee substitute. We'll deal with that in a moment. Just as a reminder, though, for everyone that we've heard just previously, there were some items that were rather generic that we asked to be addressed, and then we'll any other comments. So if we have a motion for the CS?
I move that we adopt the committee substitute for the Senate Bill 16.
Okay. We've had a motion for the movement of Senate Bill 16.
Yes, this.
Yep. Committee substitute. Any comments or objections? Okay, so adopted. On the floor, and we have Mr. Jeff Otteson. And Jeff, if there are others that didn't need to testify.
Doug was going to introduce me, but he doesn't need to do that.
Okay.
Jeff Otteson, Director of Program Development within the Department of Transportation. As you recall from the previous meeting on this bill, there were some words, I think the word periodic or periodically, was a concern, and I would just like to point to you the differences that have occurred in this most current CS. On page 3 at line 19, what was going to become periodically was now changed every 5 years to put some sideboards on it, some certainty that the department would perform this duty at least periodically. The same issue was found on page 4 at line 23. We had also used the word periodically there, and that was changed to at least every 4 years. The feeling was this was a more important duty, the consideration of alternative means of finance, and so that every administration should have a shot at least looking at this once. There was one other change made since your last CS, that's found at the bottom of page 5, line 31. This is a new subsection that would still require some form of cost effectiveness analysis for those projects that fall into the threshold. If you recall, the current language requires the consideration of costs and benefits for all new projects, no matter how small, no matter how de minimis, no matter what type. They may even be projects that are truly not projects. They may be more than administrative in nature, or they may be nothing more but a small local road. There's no lower threshold in current statute. The previous CS would have struck that entirely and left no cost effectiveness consideration in place. This is, an artful compromise that requires it on new projects that are not local in nature, that are not maintenance in nature, but are truly transportation in nature. So we're now talking about those things which are big and important, but not every little maintenance project or stop sign, I believe, as Senator Cowdery had talked about at the last hearing. It would exempt things like local roads nominated by local government, senior vans, transit buses, trails, things of that type. It would still catch the big projects. My only other recommendation to this bill, and it's not in the bill, would be that we, this new Section 5, have an effective date delayed till July 1 of 06.
So that's on page, five, right? Section 5?
Section 5, the new Section 5. And the reason for that is we have projects that are going to bid this summer that are, if you would, in the pipeline. We simply can't stop and do a cost-effectiveness analysis on those. And just to name a few, the new Brigalow extension in Anchorage, the new North Pole interchange in Fairbanks, just to name a couple that have been approved by the voters, approved by the legislature, well underway. We don't want them to be found wanting for the lack of a cost-effectiveness analysis that meets the statute. So,
Mr. Chairman.
Senatorial.
I would move this language as amendment number 1.
Okay. Hearing amendment number 1, are there comments or objections to amendment number 1? so adopted for amendment number one. Do you have other amendments?
I have no other amendments, and I'm basically my comments are concluded unless there's questions.
Let me just review the amendment. The amendment becomes section 8, is that correct?
Correct.
Okay. All right. So effective date, July 1, 2006. If you would, Mr. Otteson, could you just go over very quickly the business of facilities? As you recall, there was a deletion of facilities.
Yes, I think maybe just a short bit of history. The Department of Transportation and Public Facilities was created upon the merger of the old departments of highways and departments of public works. I believe the year was 1977. New department was called Department of Transportation and Public Facilities, and we inherited the duties of being, if you would, the public works, not only for state buildings, but at the time we were doing a lot of public works activity for smaller communities. We were doing a lot of rural school programs. We were essentially the architects and overseeing the construction of a great many types of buildings. As time has gone on, that duty has essentially dissolved, with the exception of facilities for the state itself. We no longer build schools for rural school districts. The REAs have come into being, have developed their own capacity, and are taking on these projects on their own. Even the smaller communities are now, they typically have a public works director and they do their own public works. So the department's duties have evolved over the last 30 years.
Is it fair to characterize that Senate Bill 16 essentially updates how we're doing business and makes how we're doing business practical? Is that accurate?
That's a fair characterization, and it's essentially the first real look at this set of powers and duties in almost 30 years.
And would you just very quickly restate those two time frames that used to be periodically so that we all have the understanding of the intent of 5 years and the intent of 4 years?
Again, going through them, on page 3, this is an existing section, section 11. This was a duty that the department look at the requirement for natural gas type in the automotive fleet, if you would. The department has a duty to manage the state equipment fleet. As recently as 10 years ago, natural gas was considered to be the fuel of the future, and it was a fuel that, quite frankly, the department could implement at the local level, if you would, almost the grassroots level. And we did so on a small scale. We had vehicles in Anchorage that were running around using natural gas. Mayor Fink also was using natural gas. Things have changed. That fuel is no longer in favor as the fuel of the future. It's now hybrids and hydrogen, and those programs require major R&D. They're going to be implemented, quite frankly, by global corporations, not by small grassroots activities at the local level. So we have changed this now to speak to an analysis of all alternative fuels, but and also lowered the period, the frequency by which we have to do that analysis. Because really, we're going to be watching the rest of the world in this case. The same thing happens on the duty being added on page 4. This is a recommended new duty that the department has asked to have added to its plate. And the reason here is we really have no duty to look at the finance, if you would, of transportation. And for many, many years, the finance has been pretty straightforward. The feds send us money and we spend it. Being sort of blunt, but that's essentially what it is. As we look into our crystal ball, we can see that future is changing and changing rapidly. Other states are really going in very, very dramatically different directions in how they will finance their transportation systems. Just two examples. The state of Oregon is looking at a mileage tax, which will be based upon a chip in your car that will keep track of where you've driven, and will then have a transaction between the car and the pump at the gas station, and will calculate what you owe in terms of mileage. Completely different than a fuel tax. The state of Texas is going to put a toll on every main road in the state and build their system off of toll fees. So as you can see, these are dramatically different mechanisms for funding transportation, and we think we should at least be aware of them and be able to report to you what might be necessary in the future.
Okay. So the committee members know it's the intent of the chair to move this today, and
based on the philosophy we're looking at here, this gives accountability, it's updated, and it delineates, so no matter which set of eyes looks at it, the expectation is the same, and we had some specific numbers put in for dates of examination and reporting, and the chair is satisfied, but committee members, it's important for us, if there are questions, to ask those or comments or modifications.
Okay. Mr. Chairman.
Senator French.
I'm sorry, maybe I missed the opening sentences of your presentation, and this was already explained. If so, I apologize. Part of the sponsor statement that Senator Stevens supplied with the bill talks about cost-benefit studies and the difficulty you're having with those items. Could you describe how the system works now and how this bill changes cost-benefit studies?
Yes. If you were to look at the Section 3 on page 5, the key language begins on line 6. It's language to be stricken. It says, consider means and cost of improving existing modes and facilities, state and federal subsidies, and the cost and benefits of new transportation modes and facilities. This language has been the subject of litigation that the court recently decided that the department does have to perform some type of cost-benefit analysis on new projects. The department has not always done that.
Just give me an example of a new project.
There's some issues here, but let me give you an example. A road where there's no road today.
That's the easiest example, the clearest example. Okay.
Right. So this project had been underway off and on since the early 70s. It was begun again in 1995. This issue became litigation in 2002, and ultimately we did a cost-benefit study. The court has now ruled that project may proceed. But as we looked around, we said there's a lot of other projects that have not had this cost-benefit consideration, and there are some. And the way it's written, it really casts a very wide net. It catches, if you just look at the sentence, it says, consider means and cost for existing modes, but consider benefit or costs and benefits for new modes. Well, as we looked at that and began to consider how would we structure this to implement this court ruling that we have to do this, well, how do you consider costs without the context of benefits? I'm not sure how you do it. You can say, well, this one costs $10 million and this one costs $5 million, but if you don't know what those $10 million is buying you or the $5 million is buying you, you really can't consider cost in the isolation of benefits. And so we have actually written a regulation that says we will consider costs and benefits for all projects because we don't know how to consider cost for just new projects, or for projects that are existing, I should say. It also casts a net. It applies to trails because they're a mode of transportation. It applies to senior vans that we issue to senior centers because that's a mode of transportation. There's no minimum threshold to which this current language applies. We get a lot of projects that don't come to us through our planning process, through a long-range kind of stepwise planning process. They're nominated by small communities. They're nominated by local governments and boroughs. And we have had to tell them, under the current interpretation of this law and the court's ruling, you have to do a cost-benefit analysis before you can send us your nomination. That we have a regulation in place that now requires that. We're hearing complaints from communities about this because it adds a new cost to them before they have any federal money to go really start their process. But given this language that we have to consider costs and benefits, we have no choice but to give them that requirement. We think we need to basically set a threshold. And there's a whole series of projects such as maintenance type projects, small local projects, buses, trails, where this cost-benefit consideration just simply does not need to be done. And I would just make one other comment, because you hear cost-benefit a lot. We're talking about cost-benefit that may be 10 or 20 or 30 years before the project's built, at the time you put it in the plan, not necessarily the time you're actually going to implement. And you don't have as much information, you don't know as much about it. You're basically trying to be a visionary and say, what does the state need in the future? We want to draw a line on the map and say, in the future, we intend to build this road or construct this ferry terminal. It's a very early in the game of moving from concept to implementation. We often do cost benefit as we move into implementation. then you're looking at a different question. It's not comparing Project A to Project B. It's how do I implement that particular project? Do I build it along this alignment or this alignment? It's really more, you're looking at a single project and then you're reviewing alternatives for the project. But this statute is about the planning stage, about reviewing all the projects in the state, if you would, the everything that falls under your entire umbrella.
And if I understood your answer, it sounds like many of these weighing of options, if you will, are now going to be dictated by regulation instead of by the statute. Is that right?
Well, I think the regulations would then help to define what is a cost-effectiveness analysis. If you look at the new Section 5, what is a local project, we'll have to make some definitions of those things, and I think that's best left for regulations. There's going to be a lot of detail and a lot of hashing out of specifics. But to me, it's pretty clear. We're talking about major new transportation projects still have cost-effectiveness analysis. But small bread-and-butter type projects that maintain the existing system, or small local roads and trails and buses being requested by local government, are no longer caught by this statute.
Then how would this new law have avoided the problem that you faced in the litigation over the brand new road that you wanted to build?
It wouldn't. And I should, you know, every case has a set of facts. We did a Southwest plan at the same time that project was going on, and we did a cost-effective analysis on 20 or 30 other projects that plan considered. So we were already doing that. We treated that project as a cast decision because it was underway. It was in the design pipeline. It was moving toward construction. And so we didn't want to, in fact, we had guidance from Federal Highways, our funding agency, don't revisit a project that's already underway. You may come up with a different set of facts, a different set of assumptions, and you literally may cause it to be slowed down. So we treated it as a cast decision. The court ruled treating a project as a cast decision is fine had you done a cost and benefit consideration at some point in the process. And we couldn't point to that going back to about the mid-80s. We couldn't point to a fresh one. So that project got slowed down. We looked around the state and said there's a lot of other projects that are potentially in the same situation that could also be caught by this requirement. And the fact that it has no threshold, I think to answer your question most specifically, we will have to do on that project and projects all like it, we will have to do cost-benefit consideration. It is new. It does serve more than local needs. It's a road between two different communities. To me, that's the definition of what is not local, something that extends beyond one community.
And what about the, for example, for my community in Anchorage, the road to the Kenai Peninsula has been undergoing severe and welcome upgrades over the last 10 years, and we look forward to that continuing into the future.
Well, it's clearly an existing facility, but what you're speaking to would be betterment. And I guess I think in the regulation process, we would treat that as an existing highway. The fact that it needs to be straightened or widened or passing lanes added is really betterment of an existing facility. And I think the state clearly is looking at that. And a lot of the things we do.
So if I can just make sure I understand, because what I'm trying to get a grip on is just where exactly this new system is going to differ from the old system.
Right now, we have a lot of new roads being proposed on the map. We have roads for resources, roads to Bullen Point.
It's clear to me that the new roads are still going to have to be analyzed because that's the perfect example of where you have to do a cost-benefit analysis. But where it seems like it's less clear is where, for example, on the
widening highway, the Parks Highway beyond
the Parks Highway or straightening, the Seward Highway, whether you have to stop and do a cost-benefit analysis. It sounds like under the old law, you would have. And under the new law, you would not. Is that right?
Under the old law, you would have to, because we could not consider, even though it was not new, you still had to consider cost. And to consider cost, you need context. But as I read the new, it's in Section 5, new paragraph E, it says, in evaluating a new highway, airport, terminal, or ferry, or other major component. And I think it's pretty clear to me that widening the Parks Highway is not new.
And that's the intent of the bill, is to get out of having to do a cost-benefit analysis for every upgrade, straightening, that you undertake in the state.
Right. Pavement rehabs. We're doing $100 million this year. We're just grinding up pavement. And I think everyone thinks it's needed. If you drive those roads, it's pretty obvious. But slowing down the process for a year. And just to give you an example, we spent nearly $100,000 doing that cost-benefit study for that one rural project between consultant time and staff time.
Just one other question, Mr. Chairman, if I may. The sponsor statement says that, that having to do these, you know, at the planning stage, which is 10 or 20 or even more years in advance, is burdensome because it's just too early. The implication is that it's too early in the project to be able to get a good grip on what exactly the costs and the benefits will be. That doesn't change, though, under the new subsection E. You've still got to do that, and you've got to do it, presumably, before you start turning dirt. So,
well, let me speak to that. The current language uses the phrase consider cost and benefits. A lot of people have looked at this, automatically jump to the conclusion that you have to do what is known as a cost-benefit analysis. That's a specific kind of mathematical technique to consider cost. There are four, five, six that you can point to if you look at the transportation literature for how to do this. And it's one of the most rigorous, one of the most data demanding. A cost-effective analysis, on the other hand, is a much simpler technique mathematically. It requires less data. It's less costly to perform. So we have specifically recommended in this language cost-effectiveness because it is less rigorous, less data demanding. Does not require, if you would, an economist to accomplish it. It's something that could be done by as simply as giving people a standard Excel spreadsheet and tell them how to apply the variables and it would calculate it. It could be something that could be done and live with at a relatively low cost. But there are many different ways. Just to give you an example of the court case. The court case revolved around whether or not we were using the right methodology. It revolved around whether or not we had considered external cost, such as consequences to wildlife and many other what were often called externalities. Classic transportation cost-benefit analysis looks at three things. It looks at the cost of the facility, the cost of drivers, or if you would, the savings when you build them a new road that might be shorter, and the cost of accidents. It's very hard for me to predict accidents on a road 20 years before it's built. I simply can't do that. Give you anything more than a wag. But I can do a cost-effectiveness analysis because I can go to the population people and say, what's the expected population of this community? Divide population into the number, as the assumed users, into the estimated cost. And that's about all a cost-effectiveness analysis requires.
And maybe I've been using the terms inappropriately because it's just not my area of expertise. Were you required to do a cost-benefit analysis under the old statute?
No. We ended up doing a cost-effectiveness analysis. And in the battle of the experts, I guess the court concluded on our side. But that was one of the issues that was being argued in the court case.
So your position would be that you didn't have to do cost-benefit analysis under the old statute, but you were. In any event, the new statute is going to just require you to do a cost-effectiveness.
Right. It's going to make that issue clear. Our argument was that the statute did not require cost-benefit analysis. It did not use that phrase. It just simply said consider costs and benefits. And people jumped to the conclusion that that meant the classic cost-benefit analysis. You've probably all heard about the ratios have to be above one, which means the benefits are higher than the cost. Quite frankly, rural Alaska is not a place where you find ratios above one. You know, when we build rural airports for the sake of having a safe way to get in and out, we can spend $10 million for a community of 100 people. We'll never achieve a ratio of one there. But it's a public good.
So I said one more question, but I guess I meant one more after that. Will this, in talking about new highways, what would happen if you wanted to take like an RS-2477 trail and put a highway down on top of that?
Well, I think in my mind that would clearly be a new highway. The fact that there is an easement and it has been used by, quite frankly, a different mode of transportation, walking, horse and, you know, drawn wagon, it would be hard to argue that that's truly an existing highway.
How about two-lane road to four-lane road?
I think that's an existing highway, and that's simply capacity expansion.
So a trail to a road is going to trigger a cost-effectiveness analysis, but a small road to a big road will not.
Well, I think that would be the process of regulations and the whole public vetting of regulations and where you draw that line. But if it asked to give you this sort of off-the-cuff answer, that would be my answer.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Otteson. If I might, in summation, this captures how you're doing business, updates to how you're doing business, in some respects potentially protects the state with some specificity so that we're accountable to the language and how we're doing business. So you're satisfied at this point in time that this is a good thing for DOT. When external agencies look at it, it will mean the same thing to them that it does to you. You will have some additional specificity as you get into your regulations of how to make some of these elements work. Is that accurate?
That's an accurate summation, and I would add one more. I will sleep better at night,
yeah,
knowing good. That we will less likely to be litigated on a whole cast of projects.
Very good. Unless there are additional questions, Senator Cowdery?
Yes, make a motion to move committee substitute response substitute for Senate Bill 1-6 forward to, I don't know where it goes.
Finance.
Yes,
finance, right.
With the 0-5 note, ASRAN.
And one amendment. Any comments or objections? Very good. If so moved, thank you. This meeting is adjourned.